Well, this is a workshop format, so as an introduction, you are invited to submit questions, and I have received some, and I'm going to attempt to answer some of those questions, and you'll also have an opportunity to ask questions as we go along, or we can substitute your questions for the ones that I already have. So I'm going to start with a question. Where is the center of God's universe? And now I'm going to add to that. In the book of Job, God asked Job, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Declare if you have understanding." I'd like you to take a point, and I wanted to put it in the center of you, because that's where you're going to find it. The kingdom of heaven is within you, is a quote from Jesus. Okay? So it's easy to imagine that you're in this place called Earth, and you look around you, and you probably don't see heaven all the time. Heaven is harmony. Heaven is perfection. Heaven is a one power universe. But here we seem to see competing things. And a lot of people are waiting for another day, or waiting to get happy, or waiting to solve their problems, or waiting to die and go to heaven or hell, whatever they think is going to happen. And they think it's a place. But I want to assure you, your center is where you will be forever. And you have it within your being, in your potential to understand right now. So what we're going to discover together is how it's possible for that center to become more beautiful, more beloved, more cherished, until we find that we go through states and stages of consciousness. I'm going to start my discussion with some simple questions about your divine connection, connections that everybody knows. Are there any confirmed atheists here? Yeah, I have had wonderful conversations with confirmed atheists and agnostics, and I've never had one leave and say, "There is no God." Usually their interpretation is distorted by their experiences of what they've been taught or what they believe God is. We are capable of believing anything. We can believe a lie. We can believe anything that we see with our eyes and say, "Oh, that's real," and not realize that our conception is different from the guy that's sitting next to us or standing next to us, based on our perception of the universe or perception of life. So there is no place to go other than to grow out of the experience that you're in into a happier one, unless everyone is living that perfect manifestation now. And because I can see you with my eyes and you can see me with yours, we all have room to grow. Okay. I want you to understand that this world is like a classroom, and sometimes we have bad experiences and sometimes we have good experiences, but the purpose of each one of those is to teach us grand lessons, to make the mistakes disappear. Have you ever found in your experience that sometimes events in your life kind of repeat themselves? The circumstances might be slightly different, but you see a cycle of events where you go through a series of things. It's like, "Well, I've been here before. I didn't," and what that really means is you didn't learn anything. So God says, "I really love you. Try again." It's like taking a test. And, "Well, you didn't pass, but I love you, so just try again." And when we grow, when we learn from our experiences, then we are given new, more advanced lessons. And so we start in kindergarten, if you want to call it that, right? It's this place where we can study, and then we grow. Maybe I should start with this. As one of the tenets in Christian Sciences, we take the inspired word of the Bible as our sufficient guide to eternal life. Now, a lot of people misinterpret that, or they interpret it and say, well, okay, the whole Bible is inspired, so everything is true, and everything is what God said, and it just has this kind of blank, we have to believe idea. The key word is inspired. Everything in the Bible that was written that was inspired was heard by something, a message that was not their own, and they wrote it down. In other words, they heard it from the source, from God talking or the Christ, and they recorded it. Now, you can read the Bible and not have a clue what it means. So that's not inspired for you unless you hear it from the original source. Have you ever read the Bible and all of a sudden there's a passage that just lights up? It's like, I never saw it that way before. I never read it that way before. It has new meaning to me. The moment that that happens, that message becomes the inspired word, because it's being delivered to you from the same source that it was received the first time. So it's only that little passage that becomes your guide to eternal life, because every time you get some kind of an inspired message, it says something happened that's better than anything I've ever known before. So you're learning something that's special. So why would we look to the Bible or to science and health to find a divine connection? The fact is, these are books that came from a divine source, and just reading them doesn't mean that you're getting the inspiration, but it's certainly guiding you in that direction. If there was no divine connection, the Bible wouldn't exist, and science and health wouldn't exist, and every scriptural message would not exist in the world. So someone out there thinks that there's an inspired message or that there's a divine connection. And we're going to work on that a little bit more. I'd like to start with the definition of God and see if we can relate to it. I want you to ask yourself, is there anything physical in the definition of God? Is there anything measurable in the definition of God? Is there any term for God that you can weigh, that you can isolate, that you can put somewhere and say, I can see it over there, but not over there? So as I read through it, see that each term applies to something that has nothing to do with what you see with your five physical senses. It's something else. The definition of God in Science and Health, by the way, if you haven't seen one, this is a copy of Science and Health, which is the key to scriptures, and it was written by Mary Baker Eddy, and it's a way of looking at the Bible that can make it more accessible. It teaches you how to look at scripture in an inspired way to get a message. So now I think I'll read the definition of God. All of the terms for God that she's using came out of the Bible or scriptural texts, and we'll review them. She says, God, the great I am. Have you ever thought about yourself as being I am? I can do it all by myself. So the great I am is not multiple, it's singular. So God is claiming that I am. It continues, the all-knowing. Are you all-knowing? Would you like to be? The all-seeing, all-acting, all-wise, all-loving and eternal. And then she has found seven synonyms for God. The first one that she chose was principle. You probably haven't seen that word in the Bible. because it's not there as the word principle. But it does show up, and I'll show you where it is. And also, it's also interesting why it's the first synonym for God. It means fundamental law. It is the way things operate. But also, it's also true that nothing that we're talking about here refers to anything physical. So we're talking about a principle that has no material component. The word Alpha, in Revelation it says, I am Alpha and Omega. The word Alpha can be translated as initio in Latin, or first. It can also be translated as principio. And if it had been translated as principio, then it would be, I am principle. And also, the first sentence in the Bible, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. That word that was translated for us in the King James Version came from an earlier text, Greek, that could have been initio, or it could have been principio. So the spiritual meaning could have been, in principle, God created the heaven and the earth. And that is more consistent with the eternal, because if something is eternal, it doesn't have a beginning, right? It's not initiated. It is primal. The second term that she uses is mind. Do you have any idea what that is? Of course you do, because you can think, right? But this is mind, which is singular. It is a single, omnipotent, omnipresent, one power mind. The third is soul. Soul has to do with the grandeur and the beauty and the order and the manifestation of substance without something that you can weigh or measure. And the fifth is life. So God is all the life there is and all that the life that there ever will be. And the next one, the sixth one, is actually probably pretty obvious, and it's truth. Does anybody here know what truth is? Well, have you ever been in a position to know what a lie is? The fact that you can comprehend the difference between truth and a lie confirms your divine connection that nobody can take away from you. And the seventh synonym that she uses is love. Now, I think love is the most misunderstood, the most misused word in our language. It's probably in most languages. It's misinterpreted and used everything from sensual pleasure to all kinds of I wants, right? But divine love is not that. It is an inverted image. And then she continues with all substance and intelligence. And some other attributes are omnipotence. The problem with humanity that we all experience is that we can hear multiple voices in our thought, right? Do you think you can make a choice or a decision if you're working on something? How often do you say, well, I can do this or I can do that. I can have this for dinner, I can have that for dinner, or I can marry this person, or I can not marry anybody, or I have these kinds of complicated issues, right? God never decides. Because if you live in a one-power universe, there's only one answer. And so there's never an option, never a choice, never a decision. It's always right. The easiest thing to associate with this is conscience. You have your opinions, your choices, your way, the things that you love, and then there's conscience. All those initial things that have to do with the effects of this world are your mind trying to figure things out. Conscience, on the other hand, is not your voice. Conscience is only right. It's never wrong. So if you see someone in need, you have to help them. If there's a baby that's hungry, you feed it. If someone tells you a lie, you instantly know that that's wrong. Conscience is a divine idea and a link to your divine connection. And these are things that everybody has. It doesn't matter whether you think you're an atheist. You have a conscience. And the other one that's easy to understand is intuition. How many times have you been faced with an inclination to do something and you find out later why? I'll give you a couple of examples. I have a friend who loves to ride his motorcycle. He hates to wear a helmet. In the state where he lives, you don't have to wear a helmet. So he goes down the highway at 80 miles an hour without a helmet because it feels good. This one particular day, he was heading out to go somewhere, and he felt this impulsion, put on your helmet. And he resisted, I don't like it. And he tried again, like, no, put on your helmet. So he reluctantly put his helmet on, and he headed out down the highway. He's going at a high rate of speed. And very quickly, his motorcycle went out of control. He flipped over the handlebars, landed on his head on the highway at 60 miles an hour, skidded down the highway on his head, and did a flip and landed on his feet completely unharmed. Well, that's pretty good intuition. I'll give you another example. I love stories, and I think there's something for you to remember. There was a woman working in her kitchen, and she feels impelled to go out and stand on the porch and wave. So she leaves what she's doing. She goes out onto her porch. She lived on a country road. A car passes by, and she waves and smiles. And she goes back in the house, uneventful. About 20 minutes later, she hears it again. Go out and wave. And so she's obedient. So she goes out. And the same car is now going in the opposite direction. And she waves and smiles. She goes back in the house. About 2 hours later, hears the same thing again. Go out and wave. And she goes out. The same car is now coming from the original direction. And she waves and smiles. The car pulls off the road, stops, and as a man gets out of his car. And he's in tears. He said, "You saved my life." He said, "The first time you went past, I was on my way to commit suicide. And because you waved at me, I thought somebody must love me." And he couldn't do it. So when he was on his way back, there was a kind of confirmation. And then he went home and he thought about it. And he said, "If there's a God, then she's going to come out and wave again." And so he came out the third time and she was out there waving. It completely changed his life. That is intuition. And you've all experienced it. So that's a higher level of your divine connection. Now, I'd just like to review some of those terms for God and prove to you that these terms for God are proof of our divine connection. Let's just take the word mind. Can you tell the difference between thinking and being inert? You could probably look at a stone and say it's inert, but I'm not a stone. I can think, right? You have intelligence, wisdom, and knowing. That would be impossible if you didn't have a divine connection, because there's nothing in the material senses, there's nothing in the fabric of the brain that can give you intelligence. Your brain images intelligence, but it's not it can't produce it itself. Now let's take truth. It is impossible for your brain to discern the difference between truth and a lie. It's just collecting information. Is it possible for you to tell a lie and honestly admit to yourself that you're telling the truth? Can't do it, because you have a divine connection. Let's take the word soul. Can you comprehend beauty, harmony, happiness? If you went to a concert and everyone was banging rocks on the floor, could you tell the difference between that and a symphony? It's impossible for you to know what harmony is if you didn't have a divine connection. And how about love? Do you have a sense of moral sensibility? Do you have compassion for one another? A lot of people have pets because they love them, right? Unconditionally. Why? Is it possible for you to love and hate at the same time? Or you could do it in reverse. Is it possible to hate and love at the same time? We can review some of the other ones. And some of these we might say, well, they're difficult, like omnipotence. You admit that you have some kind of power, but you can't claim omnipotence for yourself, right? Because you think you're isolated. Earlier today, I gave you the opportunity to think of yourself as a center of the universe, right? And as long as somebody else over there has got another center, then you think like you're sharing it. And omniscience, we might comprehend something about divine love. We comprehend something about truth and life, but we don't see it all. We have to work on it. And I think the one that's the most difficult is infinity. No one, while you are comprehending or looking at yourself the way you are, really knows what infinity is. But you will. So we're going to try to work at what it would be like, you know, what it takes to get there. So just for a moment as an exercise, take away everything in your divine connection that we just discussed, and what would you have? You would have no knowledge of truth, no knowledge of justice. You would have no concept of what good is. It would simply not exist for you. You would have no compassion, no sense of morality. You would be absolutely impotent. You would be mindless and lifeless. And where would you be? Could you do anything? You would be destroyed instantly. So even in this plane of existence, we are beautifully connected and supported. We don't understand at all, but let's play with it a little bit, okay? See if we can get there. What I just shared with you is the most basic connection that should be obvious to everyone based on saying, you know, truth. You want to, you know, worship truth, worship life. That's good. Then there's this giant leap that happens when you can actually commune with God in an intelligent way. Think about Moses. Moses' mother recognized him as a proper child at birth. So Moses' mother knew that he should be preserved, that there was something very precious and saintly about him. He had the good moral perception. He knew the difference between right and wrong, but he also thought he could kill an Egyptian if he was, you know, hurting a Jew. And so he had to run for his life. And then he spent 40 years tending sheep just so he could learn to be humble. And when he got humble, he saw the burning bush and God talked to him as man talks to man and gave him an impetus and a reason to live. You have to go and save all the children of Israel, those that are enslaved in Egypt. He had something that was really important to do. So that was when he heard God talk to him. Now you can call that an angel or a divine impulse. The child Samuel heard it as a child. He heard a voice saying, "Samuel, Samuel." And when he got to the point of saying, "Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth," in other words, he recognized the source, then he was fed some really vital information. Jesus was without a doubt able to break all the rules. He couldn't convince us. He couldn't show us why he could do that. But every physical law was broken by every act he did. He was in the process of proving that what you see, the laws that you make, whether they're the laws of physics or the laws of chemistry or whatever it is, they are invalid when you consider what principle is the law of the spiritual universe. So, think about Saul. Saul of Tarsus was a scholar, and he thought he knew what that book said. He studied, he may have even had it memorized. And he was absolutely clueless about the inspired word, about what it meant, until he was kind of knocked to the ground on his walk, right? He realized how blind he was. Jesus had been fulfilling these prophecies right in front of his eyes. He knew the prophecies, but he didn't get the divine connection. And all of a sudden, the divine connection happened. And he could see the relationship between prophecy and Jesus' fulfillment of it. And he realized how blind he was. And so he felt blind until his eyes were open. So as a sample, I think this might be helpful. I'm going to share a little bit of my own journey from the simplest to something that I found to be, it gave me a sense of direction. The first thing I can remember was I was sitting in a high chair with my family around a dining room table, and some people in my family, they were arguing, they were fighting with each other. I knew that what they were doing was wrong. That's a divine connection. I couldn't give it a name, I didn't really. But you see, everybody has that divine impulse. I was taken to Sunday school. I didn't like it because I knew that the teachers that I had could talk about things that were beautiful and holy, but I knew they didn't know what it meant. They didn't have the spiritual insight to prove what they were telling me. I could tell that they were saying words that they couldn't prove, so that made them hypocrites. I'm going to interject here an incident that will become relevant later. When I was getting ready to go to high school, guidance counselors gave us IQ tests. And so I got my IQ test, and they gave me the feedback, and they said, well, George, you're kind of average, and you should probably think about getting a trade, because you're not college material, basically. Okay? I wanted to go to college, and actually, I didn't have good grades, particularly. They were kind of average, except for English, which was poor. But I did get accepted in a state university. And because it was a habit, I thought, well, I'll go to Sunday school. And then all of a sudden, I stopped. And I said, wait a minute. There's nobody telling me I should do that. If it's real, then I should honor it. But I don't really know whether there's a God connection or not. So I made myself a promise. And this is really important. You have to seek it. You have to be searching, or you'll never get an answer. So I made myself a promise, and that was, I will pray about everything for one semester. And at the end of this semester, then I will judge whether prayer is relevant, valid. So I went on my way. And about a month later, I went home, and it was bitter cold, maybe 15 degrees out. And I spent the entire day outside working with my dad on some kind of a project. I was awakened in the middle of the night, and I had pneumonia, and it was so severe that I could not breathe at all. I couldn't call out. I couldn't go anywhere. And I got out of bed, and I slumped into a chair, and I reached out for anything I could hold on to, because I thought I was going to die. If you can't breathe, you're not going to last very long. And the only thing that could come to mind was that as a child in Sunday school, I was told that I was a child of God. So I used it like ammunition. This is a really basic prayer. It's not a knowing prayer. The pain, the lack of air said, you can't breathe. And I screamed. This is a mental screaming. I couldn't really talk. But I'm the child of God. You're going to die, but I'm the child of God. It hurts, but I'm the child of God. And it went on and on and on and on. Every time the thought would repeat itself, I would fire back, but I'm the child of God, but I'm the child of God, but I'm the child of God. Probably 1,000 times, I don't know. And I would say, I don't know how long it was, but after 10 minutes or so, it was as if the pain in my chest moved out in front of me, and I lost all contact with my body. There was no sensation in my body at all. It was like the pain was sitting out in front of me. I just kept it up. And after a while, it all subsided, and I was either dead or unconscious. I can't tell you, but I certainly wasn't conscious of anything. And some time passed, whatever that was. And all of a sudden, I was instantly awake, like you snap your fingers. And I still couldn't breathe. I still had pneumonia. And then what happened was there was a sensation, and it felt like the fluid in my lungs was just going, just passing out through the front of my body. And I stood up, and I was completely well. And my first response was, what does it mean to be a child of God? I had no idea. But I better find out. That was important. It was a very primitive prayer, but you know, your first healing, it doesn't take much. All you have to do is turn and desire it, and hope shows up. About a month later, I was taking engineering, and it was required for me to take an exam in chemistry. I didn't like chemistry. I couldn't see it, but it was all calculus. It was hundreds of pages of calculus, and I studied. I did my homework, and I was not getting good grades, but I always tried. And then one day, the professor says, we're going to give the entire university the same test, and we want to see how well you do. He said, nobody ever finishes this test. Just work as fast as you can. And it was going to be on everything that we had learned. So it was like 10 weeks of chemistry, hundreds of formulas. I went to my dorm room, and I was afraid. I started to cram for the test, and I just couldn't do it. Then I thought, my life is more important than this test. And I just went to bed. I woke up in the morning. Christian Scientists have a Bible lesson that they study. It's a daily study of the Bible and science and health. And I said, I'm going to do that because I'm not making any progress. So I went and I sat in a chair and I read my Bible lesson, and it was about man. And I can't tell you what the verses were, but what I can tell you was during that 40 minutes, I learned something about this divine connection, this wonderful state in which man is what God makes him to be, not what he thinks of himself. And I was happy. The test was at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up at 7. So I finished the lesson. I looked at the clock, and it was 7:45. So I had 15 minutes to get to the exam. And I said, what should I do now? I heard a voice that said, study chemistry. Well, that was the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. I took the chemistry book and I opened it up. And I started leafing through the pages, about one page a second. And I went through 300 pages of formulas. They were familiar to me, but I didn't know how they worked. And as I flipped through the pages, it all made sense. I was happy. The exam was in a gymnasium, 500 desks. I took a paper, went to the back of the room, sat down, and I just started working. After a while, I got to the end of the test. And I thought, nobody ever finishes this test. So I thought, well, maybe I made a mistake, miss a page. No, it was done. I looked up at the clock. It was 20 minutes after 8. I had finished the test in 20 minutes. It was a one-hour test. And I felt, well, I'm done. So I got up and my professor said, don't you even want to try? Because he just assumed I was bombing the test. I said, no, I finished. Well, that day changed my life. By the end of the first semester as a freshman, I was first in my class in mechanical engineering. I stayed there for the entire 4 years. I worked for the National Science Foundation. I was taking graduate level courses, including my own regular engineering, for the last 2 years that I was at Rutgers. We do not have to depend on what we see and feel ourselves to be. I know a man who was so retarded, he sat in a chair for 20 years and did nothing. He was like a blank. He couldn't respond to a single question. You couldn't talk to him. And a Christian Science practitioner, that's someone who prays for people, took him into her home. And she said, we're going to teach him to read, teach him to talk, teach him to count money. And she prayed for him for an entire year, including, and the teachers did too. At the end of that year, he was reevaluated. He could talk, he could laugh, he could memorize things. The shape of his head changed from that moronic look to being normal. He was a happy man, full of optimism and life. You could talk to him freely and he could just talk to you back. So our divine connection is a process of changing from what you think you are right now. And it'll take you through a series of examinations and opportunities that will teach you, if you're looking for it, how to grow into where you are now to experience the same states and stages that Jesus experienced, which is resurrection consciousness and the ascension. If Jesus hadn't done those things, we wouldn't know that it was possible. A caveman living in the Stone Age could have walked on the water if he knew how. How grateful are we for the Bible today? The ancient prophets would have loved to have had the New Testament. The apostles would have loved to have had Science and Health because it explained it all to them. So how important is it to take what we have? So I'd like to review briefly with you why we seem so blind, perhaps. What blinds us to this divine, infinite connection? You see, we think we're alive. God says you're not. God says, I'm living you. We think. God says, you can't. I'm thinking you. We say, I know how to love. God says, no, you don't. I am loving you into existence. You see the vantage point? We think we're looking up to God, and God is looking out from us. We are the manifestation of God. If God is mind, what does a mind do? A mind thinks. That's who you are. You are the manifestation of what mind is. So you are God's thought. You can't be the source. You are the effect. You can't take the place of cause, but you can enjoy the effect. How'd you like the effect of being loved infinitely, or being infinitely intelligent, or knowing the past, the present, and the future because it's all now? We think, well, that's impossible. Well, I want to just share with you briefly the kinds of things that are blinding us. The first one is ego. Our personal ego gets in the way. It's like a child. A child looks out upon his world and he says, I'm going to conquer the world. And then he looks around and he sees there's another one. And somebody over there wants to conquer the world too. And so all of a sudden there's a contest. And that's the whole human and material world, animated world, is you have to kill to eat. So that's the second thing that shows up, this idea of destruction. And the third one is judgment. Once you see everybody's got a little mind of their own, then I think this, and I think this, and I have an opinion, and I have a choice. If your mind is filled with judgment, you can't hear the one answer that conscience is offering. The next one is impermanence. It's this conviction that we have that no matter what we do, no matter where we go in this world, we're going to die. We can't take it with us. And that's what causes us to be faint. It's what causes us to be shy. It's what causes us to give up. It's what causes us to think that we have to fail, ultimately. And that's a terribly discouraging thing, isn't it? The next one is confinement. Now, earlier I asked you to understand or conceive of the idea that you are right now at the center of the universe, the only universe, the only view you'll ever have. Now I want you to draw a circle around yourself. We're going to call that, how big is it? How do you identify yourself? Well, the most obvious sense of confinement is our body. We think, well, this is how big I am. Well, does that look like infinite to you? And so we might say, well, I have a circle of friends, I have a circle of family, I have a circle of my city or my community or my galaxy, or ever since the Big Bang, that's the size of my circle, and I could say, well, that's forever. But I really don't understand that. But God doesn't have a terminal end, because how much does love weigh? Where is it? Can I identify it? Can I say it's here? All the terms for God are undefinable as material evidence. They can sometimes show up and you say, well, I love you, or I can feel the truth, or I know that. But the principle behind it is infinite. In order to assess what spirit looks like, we have to think past three dimensions. We think of ourselves as being in a three-dimensional universe. If each one of you is the center of the universe, how does that work? If you think about it three-dimensionally, it's like, well, I'm here and I'm over there. But each one of you is on the throne with God or with Christ. So from your vantage point where you are the center of the universe and the only center you'll ever know. And everyone else is on what they call the sea of glass. In other words, you see everyone in their perfection reflecting all the qualities that you are. And the other people are on the throne, and they're looking at you on the sea of glass. I can only give you the symbols. I can't give you the comprehension. But that's the idea, is that it's not a dimensional thing. Some people call it the fourth dimension of spirit. The next one is called despair, and it's just fear of threats. The idea that you have to hide to protect yourself. And as long as you're in the business of trying to hide to protect yourself, you are not feeling loved, you're not feeling protected, and you're not feeling safe. As long as you are mentally in a state of despair, it's blocking your vision. And the next one, everyone experiences this, I'm calling it busyness. How long can you be still and wait for divine impulse before you do something? Be still and know that I am God, or go and sell all that you have and follow me. We find that it's much easier to look at your cell phone and answer calls or text or something. And the last one is denial. And that's really hatred. Let me give you an example. Let's say that you have made a fortune in this world by cheating a little, lying a little, stealing a little. And all of a sudden, somebody comes along who knows all the evidence, knows that you've been cheating and lying, and is ready to put you on trial and declare it. Are you going to let him do that, or are you going to try to prevent him? Let me give you another experience. Let's say that you're doing everything right all your life. You've been a good person. You've made a good living. You've got good friends. And you have good possessions. And all of a sudden, you look out at your life and what you've accomplished, and you realize it's all vanity and vexation of spirit. How willing are you to let go of those possessions and make the necessary step to be alone with God until you know what it means. It's easier to say, you know, I'll think about that later. That's denying the divine impulse. And that's what prevents us from progressing. It makes us slow. Those are some of the ideas that are preventing us from growing.
Are you saying that material torments are salient?
It's not the things, it's what you make of them. You can have grand possessions in terms of ownership, but if they don't possess you, then to go and sell all you have means to lose your sense of possession of things. Okay?
But the early disciples were actually...
That was a very primitive interpretation to go and physically sell everything that you own, give it to the church and have a commune. Think about it this way. If you went and bought a mansion and you really like it and you have a mental picture of it and you have a mental picture of possessing it, right? Now take away the mansion and keep the thought as if you just bought it. The mental thing is the possession, not the thing. It's not the building. It's what you did in your mind to make you focus on something other than a grand idea that Spirit made. Now, what do we do? What is this schoolroom process that we go through to improve ourselves? The first absolutely essential element is to be humble. Absolutely humble to know that you don't know. Have you ever had conflicts or issues or life's bitterness and you get to this point where you say, you know what? I just don't have the answer. I don't know what to do. That forces us to be humble. That's one way. There's another way, and that's just childlike, simple humility. A child is often more receptive than a grown-up because they don't have these possessive issues. They don't have anything to give up because life is just good to them. Okay. The next one is, we just talked about it, it's giving up all sense of possession. When you know your life is all conflicted with things, you have to give up your sense of possessing things. And the hard ones are not the car and the mansion or the campsite or whatever it is. The hard ones are possessing your body. My body is something that I have to protect. I have to keep it healthy. I have to feed it properly. I have to take care of it. I got to let it rest. Try to lose possession of your personal responsibility for keeping it healthy. God says, I'm living you. Whose responsibility is it? If we give up our sense of possession of it, then love has a chance to embrace us and show us the beautiful side. In other words, if we're sick, we're not seeking healing. We're searching for the understanding that puts us in a place where we can recognize that we're not sick. To recognize that you're not sick brings about the health that you're seeking. So you're not starting from a negative trying to solve it. You're starting from a high vantage point and trying to prove it. That's an important state. The third one I think that's really important is to be meek. In other words, we don't go bouncing around shrieking stuff. We patiently wait for the answers to show up. And the fourth one is to strive. To want it really badly. You want to hear a story? A man wanted to know what it would take for him to know God. So he contacts someone who he thinks is a holy person. And he says, what's it going to take for me to be like you? And he says, meet me on the beach. So Saturday morning, they're out on the beach. And the holy man says, let's go out into the water. So they go out into the water. And this holy man takes this man and pushes him under the water and holds him down for a while. And then he lets him back up. And he says, what were you thinking about when you were down there? He says, I gotta breathe. I gotta get up into the air. I gotta breathe. And so this man says, when you want it that bad, you can have it. That's what's necessary. That's called striving. It's singular. I want to know what God thinks. I see this. I see a problem. I see a mess. I see health. God, what do you see? And then be meek and humble and wait for it to show up. And I guarantee you, you will get an answer, and it will probably be a surprise. In my life experience, it has always been a surprise. When you can want it that bad and wait and watch and ask an intelligent, I call it a God question. A God question is a question when you don't have an opinion about how it will work out. You can't say, thy will be done my way. You can say, whatever answer you give me will be fine. Then you are humble enough to hear it. The next one is to practice listening to conscience. Conscience is available to you and me right now, right here. And conscience is giving you information about a one power universe that's always right. And it will lead you to eternal life. And the next one is to obey intuition. And I think I shared a couple of good experiences with you about that. What's the result? If you're willing to do these things, there's an interesting quote I found in Science and Health, and it says, as mortals gain more correct views of God and man, multitudinous objects of creation, which before were invisible, will become visible. Do we believe that? I'm suggesting that you strive for it, because opportunities will occur. They will be provided for you. It's like this African family that they had a little hut along the side of the road, and they didn't have any food. But the father got up and he said, we must prepare. We must be ready for it. And so he got his wife to set the table, and they put out all the dishes and the glasses, and they sat around the table, and they were waiting for the opportunity to be blessed. And about 1 o'clock, somebody showed up with a pot of food. You see, it's an opportunity that would not show up if you were crying in the corner. You wouldn't have been available and waiting for that. If you're listening to that conscience, you will be fed. Now, I have a few additional questions I'd like to answer. Okay, the first question that I have is, it's a question from the Bible in Genesis. It says, and God said, let us make man in our image and after our likeness. And the question is, what's the difference between image and likeness? They sound like they're the same. If there were two politicians in front of you, and they're both good looking, they both have a really good platform, they both have a wonderful resume, they both say they're honest, they both say they're hardworking, one of them actually is, the other one is a liar. How do you know the difference? They both have the same image of goodness, but one doesn't have the likeness that they are professing. If you were a scribe reading what Isaiah said in the Bible, you might say it this way. The Spirit of the Lord was upon me because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, and set at liberty them that are bruised, and preach the acceptable year of the Lord. Okay? But along came a guy named Jesus. And he stood up and they gave him the book of the prophet Isaiah. And Jesus said it this way. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord. This day is this scripture fulfilled in your ears. He had the image that Isaiah was prophesying, and the likeness, it matched. So that's image and likeness. Now, in your life, you have to read that passage the way Jesus did, or whatever virtues you have, you have to identify with them and live them. So it is image, and then you have to be like that, right? You have to believe and actually do the good that you're professing. Question number two. This person says, there was a time when life was happy, simple, and good. I had confidence. Now life is hard. I seem to have lost my way. Can I get it back? Well, if we understand that life is a classroom, then you can follow the process to find your way out. I'll share an experience with you. We have all had things like this. I was recently divorced. I had no job for the summer. I had very little money, and I was really depressed. I went to live with my mother. I was 40 years old. Living with my mother was not easy. I had a design studio that I thought, well, maybe I could get it. I can do some work for the summer. So I went to the studio. There's nothing I could do. I said, I have to have answers to these questions. And I realized over the years I've read the scripture, and sometimes when you open the Bible and you open to something and you don't really understand what it is, and go to another passage, I realized that I was skipping over passages that I didn't understand. And then I made this connection. I've been living my life like that. I've been thinking that I can pass over the hard parts and just ignore them. And I said, I can't do that anymore. So I went into my design studio and I pulled out a big table and I set it out and I got the Bible and my Science and Health and other inspirational material that I had and concordances. I laid everything out in order because it was very important that I follow all the steps and don't miss anything. I took a big stack of yellow pads and on the first pad I wrote, what is love? I intended that entire pad to answer that question. Then I sat down and I started reading and listening. That first day, I sat there for 10 hours. I wasn't tired. This was useful work, and I thought that I could get answers that way. At the end of the day, I went home to my mother's house. Next day, I came back and I did it again, 10 hours, striving to understand what love is, and anytime there was a question, I would write the question out. If I got inspired by something, or I thought I understood something, I wrote it down, I copied it down so I would have a ledger, I could review those things. I sat there day after day after day for about 2 months. And one day, I got up and I went out into the yard, and a little patch of grass behind my building. And I was just, deep in contemplation, searching for the answers about what love was. And I can only tell you what happened. I can't share it with you. In my experience, the world dissolved, disappeared. I was standing in the presence of two other people. We were all transfigured. We were transparent, but completely identifiable. The two people that were facing me, I recognized. They were people that I knew, people who I thought had wronged me. We were communing with each other. We weren't talking with our mouths. Communication in this level of consciousness is universal. I knew everything they were thinking. They knew everything I was thinking. We were standing on what is described in the Bible as a sea of glass. Everything was emitting light. Everything was singing, "I am." Everything had a living presence. All ideas have form, but they're not three-dimensional. The veil was taken off, and I understood what the veil was. The veil is your personality. Everything that you have conceived of since you've been born, and you've accepted some things and rejected other things, you've judged things, you've got your ego problems, and your, "I want to do this and I want to do that." It was like lifting it off. We were incredibly beautiful. Indescribable in terms of the human environment. And all of a sudden, it was like this hand came from behind me and ripped it away from me, and everything went black. And I heard this impulse that said, "You can't look at that." There was some fear that had entered my thought, some moment of fear, and the vision disappeared. That was a really significant moment in my life, where I felt this divine presence and divine connection that was far beyond, you know, intuition. And I was a living presence that equals the kinds of experiences that you read about in the Bible. The immediate result of that was that those two individuals who had given me so much grief and so many reasons to not like them, I couldn't do it anymore. Whenever I thought of them, all I could see was that incredibly beautiful, loving, special, intelligent being. I went home to my mother's. It was a completely different experience. My mother was difficult to live with. For the first time in my life, I was enjoying her company. She was laughing and smiling. She prepared a meal that was probably one of the nicest meals I've ever had. And she wasn't a great cook. But you know what? It was delicious, and I was enjoying her company. That was the immediate effect of that experience. So we all are capable of finding that the center that's within us can be transparent, transformative, and be an incredible blessing. It changes your view of everything. For years after this experience, whenever I had a problem, I could mentally go back to that place where the vision was, and the answer was there. It was waiting for me to uncover it, to discern it. So I think that answers the question to the lady who couldn't find her way home. You can. I'm going to give you a little metaphor here. If you ask a child where water comes from, they might run to the kitchen sink and say, "Mommy, it comes from the kitchen sink." But mommy knows it doesn't come from the kitchen sink. It comes from a deep well or a reservoir, a river, lake, somewhere. How much water is in the well? The only way you would know is to open the faucet and let it run. You are the faucet, and the water is love. The only way that you will know what God's love is to pour it out of you. Open the restriction gates, your blindness. Just pour love out. The more you pour love out, the more it multiplies. The more real it becomes to you. To love your neighbor as yourself is identical with loving the Lord thy God with all this, with all your heart and with all your mind and with all your soul. I encourage you. Be the faucet.